the summer.
It is sweltering.
It is hot, hot, hot here at Good Muslim, Bad Muslim.
What's the hottest it's been for you? Like the hottest temperature, the hottest?
122.
Holy shit.
In Palm Springs.
You know that means that technically, like in a car, it's like 135 degrees.
It was so, so hot. It was so hot that when I walked out of the hotel, like my skin was burning, and then I went back in, and the next day it was like, I don't know, like 107, 102. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's so cool out. That is how hot it was. I was out there on a writing retreat. I've been traveling a lot for the past month. I was in Detroit for the Allied Media Conference, and then I went to Texas for a wedding, and then I went to the desert to try and write, and now I'm back.
You're going to tell us about Texas, too.
Yeah, I'll tell you about Texas in a
bit. I'm a Cali girl afraid of Texas still.
I'm also, yeah, we're going to get to that.
We're going to dive into that. We're also going to dive into some
sexy talk.
Some sex.
It's going to be our third episode where we talk about sex. Ooh. Before we talk about that, you were just at Sundance.
I just was about to say, I was at Sundance!
How was it?
Oh my God. Well, gorgeous.
And just to be clear, you weren't there for the film festival. You were there for a retreat.
Yes. I went for the Creative Change Retreat, which is put together by Alan Jenkins and Betsy Richards. Thank you both so much. Thank you also Amy Redford, who lets us host it there. And we went ziplining.
That zip line looked like it was really high up.
It was roller coaster high.
It looked higher than a roller coaster. It looked frightening.
But it was so cool to go with all these like social justice peeps.
Yeah.
And like artists and collaborators and mischief makers. And like, you know, when you're like around your folks who like you're all in on the same context, you don't have to like start the conversation at zero.
What if you lose your grip on the handle?
You die.
You just fall?
Just plummet, yeah. No, actually, Sundance was like a really perfect place to try ziplining.
Why?
Because they have like 4 safety mechanisms.
Oh.
There are some places that you go ziplining where like you like hold a pulley with your hand.
Okay, I just got back from watching Girls Trip, and they have a scene in the movie where they zipline across the party area.
Is this the Lena Dunham movie?
This is not the Lena Dunham movie. This is the Queen Latifah movie and Jada Pinkett Smith movie and Tiffany Haddish movie.
Oh, damn it, that's embarrassing.
Totally different, Zara. And they're in New Orleans, and they go ziplining across where all the parties are happening underneath them. And then there's a scene where, like, Jada really has to go to the bathroom.
And so she ziplines across the party?
The zipline doesn't make it through, Zara.
Oh, no.
And stuff happens.
Oh, dear.
Not going to tell you what happens, but you should really watch the movie. It was hilarious.
I remember the teaser now.
Yeah. The teaser was right.
This is like a movie I'm going to take my mom to. My mom like has...
I don't think you should take your mom.
My mom has a super raunchy sense of humor.
But this is like... pretty raunchy.
Her other favorite film is Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo.
You should totally take your mom to this movie. Your mom would love this movie.
I'm like not exaggerating.
This and is like also, the black female version of Deuce Bigelow, basically.
The perfect mom-daughter movie.
I would not say so, but maybe in your mother's situation. Anyway, so when you talk about ziplining, that's my visual. You going across the forest and not able to contain your pee.
That's what you imagine?
I just saw the movie like 2 nights ago. It's very, very vibrant in my head.
I think that's the only reason why people zipline, actually.
Right?
Yeah, like I had to use the bathroom on the mountain, and I was like, screw climbing down a mountain.
No, yeah.
I'm going to zipline to the parking lot.
Mark my territory.
Just give me 2.5 hours to strap and carabiner and harness and take a ski lift up to the top of the mountain. Then I'm going to go down the mountain, and then I'll pee.
Were there bathrooms at the top of the mountain?
Actually, there were porta potties that were called honey pots. I just thought that was really funny that they were called...
That is super funny.
Honey pots.
Because what kind of honey is in those pots? On that note, let's talk about sex.
Oh, yeah. That's so hot.
Totally segue.
Totally hot.
Totally hot.
This is a sex episode.
We're talking about sex because... there was a manual that just came out recently. It's called the Muslima Sex Manual, a halal guide to mind-blowing sex.
How's it going?
Is that your sexy voice? Zara, tell us about this book because you were very into reading the Amazon preview of it.
Yeah, okay. So as soon as I heard about it, of course, I wanted to see the foreword.
Yeah.
And
of course, I, as the single Muslim woman, am not allowed to read this because this is only a guide
exactly what it says.
For the married woman. Zara is married, So this is why Shazara was reading it.
Yeah, and I'm the only one who can read this book of the two of us.
Exactly.
So I have to lead this conversation because you're not allowed to read this book.
Well, you can tell it for our married listeners.
Okay, so if you're not married, shut your ears right now. Just shut them.
So what did you learn?
All right, so there are some things, according to the author, that are unanimously haram.
Unanimously.
They are? Anal sex and porn.
Haram.
But I didn't know this as a married woman.
Now you do, Zara.
Uh-oh, too late.
And there is something else she says. She talks about how this guide is for women.
Okay, there's like a really lengthy disclaimer.
Yes, I thought it was funny.
At the top of the book, which I understand because whenever you're like doing anything on behalf of all Muslims, that's a bit intense. It's religion.
Yes.
And people take that to heart. Some people believe in religion.
Yes.
I'm not an atheist. People always get this wrong about me. That's for a different conversation. We're talking about sex right now.
We are talking about sex.
I just think it's really interesting that this book is like, here's everything to know, but you have to be married, you have to be married, you have to be married.
Yeah. She was very clear in her foreword that this is a manual for married folks, and it's a manual for women folk.
And she makes a claim where she says, what is amusing in a sad way is that many younger Muslims think that the practicing, masjid-going, hijab, niqab-wearing sisters have dull sex lives and never venture outside of the vanilla. Not true. I have a theory that Muslims are actually kinkier than non-Muslims because we bottle up all that sexual energy and provide only one outlet, that of marriage.
Totally true. I mean the kinky part, not the marriage
part.
So
one day you're going to get hella kinky, Taz.
Apparently.
But for right now, you're just a little bottle.
I'm totally a little bottle.
You're a little bottle of kink.
Just a genie in a bottle.
Meanwhile, I'm over here having a very, very rollicking sex life.
Yeah?
Oh, I mean, I'm long distance often, but...
The manual is saying that you're allowed to have raunchy sex.
Yeah.
And dirty sex is okay. I liked how she used these words like dirty and raunchy. I don't know. Her word choice in this is just really interesting. What was also fascinating was that this book came out because the author, her name's Muladat, and it's an anonymous name. It's not her real name. She wrote this up for a friend of hers, and then her friend sent it out to more of her friends, and then there was a request to turn this into an actual book. So that's how this book came about, was, you know, it was basically a zine that went viral, and now she got a book deal.
I kind of think it's funny that, like, it was a zine in a way, actually.
I call everything a zine. I think all of those pamphlets my dad had from the mosque were all zines.
Because our last sexy episode was about gin.
Yeah,
in
gin
your penis.
Gins in your penis.
Which, if you're wondering what's going on with your penis and why there are gin in there, you should check that one out.
Also, in some ways, I feel kind of sad, though, that there are, like, Muslim women out there who were so sheltered.
Hmm.
I know this is the case. I'm not saying that this is all Muslim women, but there's definitely some Muslim women who are so sheltered. They, you know, stay away from all the haram stuff that when they get married and they jump into it, they don't know what they're doing. They don't have help. And I think this is a good way for Muslim women to feel empowered and to embrace their sex life.
Yeah, I do appreciate it for that reason.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always healthy to be able to break away from the puritanical and sexist, I will say, requirement. I guess I'm feeling it in that way that, like, people look down on women and put shame on women.
Yeah.
That's very, like, physical. The eye on women to be ashamed of their sexuality and their sensuality.
Yeah, that they're not supposed to be enjoying the sex that they're having.
Don't enjoy sex. Don't be sexy.
Yeah.
Cover your curves.
Yeah.
Your peaks and your valleys. Your elbows and your knees, I guess.
Your ankles.
Your toes. I mean, anything that relieves that pressure.
Yeah.
Is good.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I just feel like the one place where I'm like, nope, can't do that, is when you say unanimously haram.
Yeah, there's definitely some problematic language in this booklet.
Like, I'm cool with you saying that you believe that to be true.
Yeah.
I'm not cool with you saying that, like, it is true.
Yeah, because this unanimously Muslim phrase, like, what is unanimous? We've learned over the course of this podcast, there are all kinds of Muslims out there. There's all kinds, not even just all kinds of Muslims, but all kinds of, when it comes to the Orthodox side, there's all kinds of orthodoxy and there's all kinds of...
Orthodox is even an accurate term.
Exactly.
Conservative is just like about as far as you can say without having to like label sex that I don't know to label because that's not in our media vernacular.
And also how history is remembered, too, when it comes to the narratives about being Muslim, you know, like what might have been halal now might have been reinterpreted as unhalal just a few hundred years ago. I'm also saying this because I just finished Michael Muhammad Knight's book, Tripping with Allah, which is all about doing drugs and how it connects to Islam. And a lot of what he talks about in that book is talks about how what is drug, what is wine, what is coffee, and how these vices were interpreted in Islam changed not just based on the book, but also based on where we were in the year and in history, which gave me a lot to think about.
I did appreciate her line where she like mentions, consult your local scholar. I was like, oh, that's nice.
That's nice.
So speaking of sexy.
Speaking of sexy.
But also halal.
So halal.
Aladdin.
Aladdin was my first crush. And it was a halal crush because he was a cartoon. Right? Isn't that how that works?
Yeah, sure. You did. Right?
I kept it in the bottle. Like the genie in the bottle. And it was just a cartoon. It wasn't like I had a crush on a real guy.
Nope.
It was just, you know, colors, painting, and animation.
I'm really fascinated that like, because, okay, the conversation around Aladdin has like gone super viral, right?
Last week was so ridiculous. This article came out saying that they were casting for the live version of Aladdin.
The Disney movie.
And they were having a hard time casting the characters because they couldn't find anyone brown who also could dance and sing.
What?
And then everyone on the internet was like, what?
And everyone in the world.
Nation! Outside of
Bollywood.
Western.
Hello?
Yes, Bollywood. Belly dancers, whatever. Like, every single region of the quote-unquote Orient has dancers. And so everyone was all upset. And then the conversation moved to saying, like, well, maybe Riz Ahmed should play it. All these people that were saying, like, oh, so-and-so should play and so-and-so should play. So, you know, people were saying Riz Ahmed. But then people who are Arab were saying, like, it shouldn't be played by a South Asian. It should be played by an Arab. But then East Asians were saying, well, actually, if you look at the original version of Aladdin, it was actually supposed to be a Chinese boy. So it should be a Chinese Muslim kid who's a beggar who plays Aladdin.
This was, like, totally news to me.
This is all...
That it originated in China.
And then I totally went down the rabbit hole based on all of these tweets that were coming at me last week. And then it turns out that the story that is now a part of the 1001 Arabian Nights wasn't originally a part of it. And it was like folklore that was being told on the Silk Trade route. And then a French guy heard it and then added it later to the 1001 Arabian Nights. So in my head, it's all fucking Orientalist anyways. So it doesn't matter who plays it.
You mean Disney would take a problematic story out of history that is based in no fact nor truth and present it as
truth?
Well,
I think I would prefer this kind of a narrative to be Disney-fied because it is so fictional and there are so many different layers to it versus a Pocahontas narrative or a Mulan narrative, actually based on someone real. And you really do want to hold some sort of litmus test to reality and history. Whereas this one, it's kind of like, well, this whole story is like super Orientalist.
It was like already, yeah, like an urban legend on the Silk Road.
Yeah.
So it makes sense for it to be Disney-fied.
It makes sense. Totally
for
makes sense.
For once.
Yes.
For once.
For once.
Okay. Also, I find it really interesting that like nobody's talking about Jasmine's hot top.
What do you mean?
Well, if we're going to be Disney accurate, that's a pretty sexy top that Jasmine wears.
I know. It's very skimpy. Also, since all that hoopla happened, mm-hmm. the casting was announced. So they actually did cast a Middle Eastern boy to play the role of Aladdin, which is awesome. But then for the girl, they ended up casting a half Indian, half white girl to play Jasmine.
Interesting.
And this goes back to my Big Sick article, this whole like idea that to have brown women on the screen, there needs to be some association with whiteness. And I mean, she looks kind of like a white girl.
So, okay, I remember when I went to go see Aladdin and I saw Jasmine.
Yeah.
And her outfit and her cleavage. And I remember looking at my parents like,
isn't she 16? Or whatever, teenager.
It's just like, okay, guys, like, hold up. Some mixed messages at home right now.
Why can I not wear this?
And she had a tiger.
And she had a tiger. I wanted a tiger. Do you know who they cast as the genie?
Who?
Will Smith.
Oh.
I know.
Oh, interesting.
I know.
Is he gonna sing?
Is he playing the role of the magical Negro in this character? You know, like, what is happening?
Oh, how did I even miss that?
What?
I totally missed that.
I know.
Disney.
Or maybe we're just, like, putting too much on it. Maybe it's not.
It's not like Disney has any influence.
Right?
I mean, who's looking at Disney for role models?
So I consulted with Jenny Yang, our friend and comedian, and we decided that Aladdin should have been played by Avan Jogia.
Which you should look up right now. I did.
Google image him.
If I was gonna, like, type a guy, like, if we were in high school and I was gonna pass a note to you, I'd be like, he's a total Aladdin test.
Yeah, totally.
like dead on.
He looks just like Aladdin.
Can he sing?
I think so. I think he grew up in that world of entertainment singing.
What can I say except...
But hey, next time...
Oh, what?
Next time...
Yeah?
Disney or Aladdin or whatever, anyone needs like help consulting, I'm there. I'm down. I'm down to help with that casting call.
You need to call up Taz.
I can help you with your Muslimness.
All right, so it's interesting that there are all these like representations of brown folks and Muslimish, because Aladdin has always been like Muslimish.
Totally.
Right? Representations that are positive.
Yes.
Have been on the rise.
Yes.
And yet, hate crimes
are on the rise too. So CARE came out with a report that says that in 2016, the first 6 months of 2016, they compared it to the first 6 months of 2017, and hate crimes are on the rise by 91%. And they looked not just at the actual physical attacks, but they also looked at hate incidences when people say something very hateful to someone. So they're looking at this at CARE, and Thesby from Good.is, she wrote this amazing article about media representation and how that compares to the rise in hate crimes. Go check it out at Good.is. And, you know, it had a really, lot of good points. So we see Muslims in media. I've been watching The Bold Type, which is this new TV show, and their first storyline was this Iranian artist who comes to New York to exhibit, and she's a hijabi Iranian, but she's queer, and it talks about her having to deal with being Muslim and queer. It's on Hulu. The reason why this came up in my feed is because of the way she was wearing her hijab. People were saying, oh, she's not wearing her hijab right. She's not doing it right. They need to have a Muslim consultant.
Yeah, I appreciate that somebody mentioned that, like, yeah, hashtag not all women wear hijabs the same way. That's a long hashtag.
Yeah.
It's really complex. I don't even know where to start. Like, a lot of Iranian women also pull back the hijab. Like, for some Iranian women, that's a form of resistance.
I know. I think you have to see the picture of how she's wearing it.
And for some Iranian women, that's just, like, how they wear it. It's just cultural. So, you know, if you want to, like, put it in a box and, like, call it one thing or another, yeah, women wear clothing in different ways.
That's true.
Didn't we fatwa talking about hijab?
We did. We're talking about media representation. And this is a new show, and it just came out. Outside of The Bold Type, there's also Degrassi. Degrassi High. My sisters loved that show growing up. And now this new class, there's a storyline about a queer Syrian female who comes to Canada. And it talks about her storyline about being a refugee and wearing her hijab. And her hijab comes off and she falls in love with another girl. So there's that kind of representation going on, which I think is kind of awesome. It's awesome to see queer Muslim female narratives happening. We also saw that with the new HBO show Brown Girls that's coming out. It was a YouTube series, so that was out there too. But I also think that there's other forms of Muslim representation that's out there. So yes, we're seeing a lot of Muslim representation in a lot of pop spaces, such as magazine covers and on TV shows and on billboards and at the mall. And it's been great to see. It's been great to see this representation. But at the same time, you know, as this representation is happening, it's not really affecting our hate crimes. Our hate crimes are going up.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because there's the whole good Muslim narrative that is like, so long as we continue to push a positive representation, then that will solve for everything. We'll all hold hands. We'll all get along.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really dubious claim. I think that comes from a lot of conservative Muslims.
Absolutely.
That are like, hey, conservative Christians, we're anti-queer like you, and we're anti-reproductive rights like you, and we are like sex shaming just like you when it's not in a bottle before marriage. So we're just like you. Let's be friends.
Yeah. And it's not working because we're getting more attacks than ever. It doesn't matter how many brown faces we put on primetime TV of, quote, good Muslim. It's not working. And I think all these Muslim organizations that are out there that are saying we need to have just good Muslim representation in the media, it's not working. It's not helping. Mm. We just need to make Muslims human. And human doesn't mean making them good. It just means making them good or bad. Just human. Just normal. Just make us normal.
Faults and all.
Yeah. So hire us.
Hire us.
Basically, hire us to be your Muslim consultant.
I'll be Jasmine.
I will be whoever is on Aladdin's arm. You know, one of the things I was thinking about when I was in Texas is this media representation is very real. We were in Texas. We were in Austin. We were outside of Austin for a wedding. And we went to this restaurant. It was a Southern cuisine restaurant. And it was me, my sisters, and my dad. And it was around mug rib time. My dad says that he wants to go pray. And me and my sisters are just kind of rolling our eyes. We were like, why didn't he do this at the hotel before we left? We're at this place where there's nothing but white people all around us. And we're in the South. And
he's in Texas praying outside.
And he wants to pray outside. So he goes to the restaurant. Bathroom to do wudu, and then he's like, oh, I'll just pray in the back. And I am freaked out.
I'm sweating just hearing this.
And so I tell my dad, I'm gonna go stand on the corner. And he's just kind of like scoffs, and I was just like, I'm just gonna do it anyway. So I go and I stand on the corner, and he prays in the car. And then when he comes back to me, I like start talking about, listen to the birds, how great they are, you know, just because I don't want him to feel bad. I don't want to make him feel like I'm watching him. And he gets really upset with me when we're all at the airport, and he says he wants to pray. I'm like, let me see if I can find you a prayer room at the airport, because that there's a lot of airports that have prayer rooms now. And he was like, why are you always like that? And I was just like, man, like, he must think I'm so ashamed of him. And it made me feel terrible, but at the same time, I don't trust wherever I'm at, you know, like, I do this as a living, like, I read the news, and I know, the thing that I kept thinking about was, like, he came here in the 1970s, and it must have been so safe for him back then to, like, pray and be in public and be externally Muslim, and I felt terrible, but at the same time, the phrase that keeps turning in my head is the phrase that they kept yelling at me when I was a teenager, and it was, it's not you I don't trust, it's everyone else I don't trust. And that's kind of what I feel. It's not that my dad I don't trust, it's everyone else in America that I don't trust. And I think it's kind of funny that's...
Oh, what a flip.
What a flip, right?
Wow. I'm just taking that in. I saw you post about it on Twitter, and I connected with that because I have the same thing with my folks where they're like, either I veer into the territory of being paranoid for them.
Yeah.
About travel.
Totally.
I have a family member who wants to get married, and their wedding is in China. So, you know, they're inviting all these other Iranian-American guests to travel out of the country in October. Guess what else is happening in October? The Supreme Court is deciding the ban.
Yeah.
It's going to be a great time for convenient confusion, whatever direction it goes.
Yeah.
And I'm very worried.
And your family's from one of the countries, one of the six countries. Iran is one of the
seven,
countries.
Yeah, one of the seven. Yeah, Iran. Oh, yeah, wait. It's now six, right? Because Iraq was taken off the list recently. Anyway, I either veer into the territory of being paranoid, or it's because I'm ashamed.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I try not to take it to heart, and I try to, like, dialogue through it, because I think the shame accusation is, you know, my parents want to be able to, like, provide for me.
Yeah.
And I think they get actually ashamed that this isn't something they can protect me from.
Yeah.
And I think it's deep.
It's very deep.
Yeah. It's so painful.
Yeah. It's so complicated and hard, but, you know, this is the reality that we have to live in.
I also can't believe that your dad was like, I'm going to pray at an airport in Texas. Like, of course that's your dad. You know what I mean?
Dad. Of course that's always my dad.
I would just be like whispering into my lap, Allahu Akbar, Bismillah,
He ended up praying sitting down.
Maybe like stealth prayer. I could like grab a soda fountain drink and I would just like be sipping and praying at the same time. Just like, what's up? I'm just like you, Texans. What's going on? Sip, sip. All right, you want to hear about ways we're winning?
Yes, ways we're winning.
It's time for some Creeping Sharia.
Creeping Sharia.
Okay, Zara, you take the first one.
Beyonce had twins. One of them is named Rumi. Rumi is the best Muslim of all time. He was the drunk gay Muslim.
Also, she named her daughter Rumi.
That's powerful.
Why is it powerful?
Well, A, I just love that she, like, traverses the gender binary and it's just like, bam.
Yeah, sure, that's what she's doing.
I'm going to call it that. I love that. Also, it's not that unusual to me because, like, Shiva, for instance, is a really popular girl's name in Iran.
Shiva. Huh.
Yeah, very popular.
Strange. Strange, but, speaking as a South Asian, right? Because that's a very male Hindu terminology.
Yeah, so it's not unheard of. I don't know where that comes or what that is or what that's about, but it happens.
Okay, and your second?
It's Beyonce.
So Beyonce and Jay-Z filed a trademark on the twins' name, Rumi and Sir. They trademarked Rumi Carter and Sir Carter, and they are registered with U.S. authorities.
So what does that mean? What protection
Jay-Z
does that
mean? Trademarked Rumi. But I guess he trademarked Rumi Carter versus just Rumi, which I think is a little bit
I think that would be a bit intense. Does somebody have a trademark on, like, Prophet Muhammad?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure there is someone out there with lots of money.
Because I own onbehalfofallmuslims.com and onbehalfofallmuslims.world. I'm actually serious. I pay $40 a year and I own it.
All yourself.
Yeah, I just wanted it.
You should trademark it.
That's a little out of my price range. Nah, I'm not a Rumi Carter. But I will say, like, if there was one person that I'd be cool with, like, owning the trademark on Rumi, it would be Beyonce.
But would it be Jay-Z? See, that's a thing.
That's tough.
That's a tough thing.
That's tough.
My creeping Sharia is Rihanna's boo. Rihanna is dating 1.5 billionaire Hassan Jameel. Saudi Arabian Hassan Jameel. They made their money off of Toyota cars being sold in Saudi Arabia. And there was this picture where you could see Rihanna and Hassan Jameel in a hot tub.
Oh, damn.
I know.
Okay, so she's like the second pop star to like be chilling with, like dating or sort of. We don't know if they're dating yet. That's the thing. That's why I'm like.
Oh, Rihanna's definitely dating him.
Oh, like that's
there was
confirmed?
Definitely a picture of them kissing. So I don't know if kissing counts as dating in your world or not, but it's pretty confirmed.
For you, like you're still in the bottle.
I'm totally in the bottle.
You don't just kiss guys.
Like, Janet Jackson.
Well, they divorced.
They divorced
it
after.
Didn't go well.
After the prenup was. Had come to a dent, so she got her money.
But is this like a thing? Like, what is the deal with like pop stars and like
rich
billionaires? Yeah,
I don't know. Why can't rich like billionaires be with like activists? You know?
Yeah, I'm not available, but
you could be available for enough $1 billion. Is that what you're saying?
Sounds like a good time. I'm just suggesting.
I think something could be worked out. I definitely could work something out. So if there's any billionaires listening to this podcast, I will totally put aside my values if it could get a prenup with you and get a fraction of that money.
Wait, okay, so like you just said, like you didn't even try. You were like, I will throw out my activist values
capitalist. I'm going to hide them for a little bit while we make it through the prenup. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, that's the other thing that cracks me up, that you just like already gave into the prenup.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Like, you didn't go for the whole, but for the end of time.
No.
Why would we need a prenup if you love me,
I'm definitely
me,
going in for the prenup.
So you're just like, I want, like, a billionaire lifestyle for, like, a couple of months.
Well, if I get the prenup, then I'm going to have a good lawyer, Zara.
Oh, okay.
I know lawyers.
All right, we need to get you hooked up with a billionaire.
Yep. That's
it's a hell of a bachelorette party.
Then I'm going to read that Muslima sex manual and learn a lot of things to get me ready.
Oh, we've got to open your bottle, Taz.
My bottle is waiting to be opened, apparently.
And Will Smith will be there to tell you what to do.
Oh, Will Smith. Fatwa. My fatwa is, okay, so here's the thing. We have had fatwas in the past where we fatwa'd bacon, right? And bacon, we were particularly talking about how mosques have had bacon on doorknobs. Well, this past month, a mosque in Sacramento had the Quran delivered to them in a Tupperware bin full of lard. And when you opened up the Tupperware bin, it was a Quran inside.
That's friendly.
Lard. I know. So kind.
What a friendly gesture.
What a nice gesture.
That doesn't sound at all violent.
It looks like they learned our lesson that bacon is not kryptonite, but now we need to explain to them that lard is also not kryptonite. It's not going to hurt us. Just stop sending pig products. Someone can eat that. I also think, you know, because all these incidences are happening in Sacramento, I bet it's all connected to someone who owns a pig farm or something like that. And maybe they have an excess. And they're like, oh, we've had enough bacon for the day. We're going to just send it to the mosque. I don't know.
I'm going to hang out on the other side of this conversation where my reaction is, hey, if we want to keep the crimes at pig products, let's leave it there and not venture into the territory that has been, which is shootings and baseball bats.
Murder. It's true. If you just want to send us pig stuff, just do that instead of stabbing
us. Yeah.
Maybe that.
We'll keep it 100 at lard.
You have an interesting fatwa.
I have a fatwa on top of a jihad.
Yeah.
How's that going to go?
I'm confused already by trying to figure out the definitions behind both.
Okay, so Linda Sarsour, who we love.
We love her.
Linda Sarsour was recently accused of using the word jihad in a sentence.
Yes.
and choosing it as a word poorly.
Actually, what had happened was that she was at the ISNA conference and she gave a keynote speech. And in that keynote speech, she was talking about how right now the jihad is being a patriotic American, something along those lines of like our jihad is to be here and be established. And the right took it the wrong way.
Of course.
And they exerted that word jihad and they ran with it. And she's been attacked for the use of the word jihad, not just by the right, but by all kinds of people.
So what she basically said, for people who don't know, is she basically said the pen is mightier than the sword.
Yeah.
That was like literally, that's the way that she used the word.
And the definition of jihad is really just struggle. Like we all have internal struggles
that we battle. It's self-care.
And it's self-care.
It's self-preservation. It's your midnight cheese.
What really bothers me about this are the Muslims that are saying that, well, she knew what she was getting herself into by using that word.
That's my fatwa, is that reaction. That's fucked up.
Yeah, why can't we use the words that we were raised to use in our faith?
And we have to be there for each other in reclaiming that terminology.
Absolutely.
It has been perverted and misused by everyone, including Muslims. And for her to reclaim it as an act of like self-preservation is its like truest meaning.
Yeah, it was a beautiful speech. I watched it on the live stream and I totally was inspired by it. I'm completely inspired by her. I think, you know, this whole use of words, this came up on season one of Good Muslim, Bad Muslim when we were talking about the terminology of ISIS versus Daesh.
Right.
We talk about how words are powerful and what words we choose to use really makes a difference. And how we reclaim words really makes a difference. Like our use of the word fatwa in this situation. I spoke with a fan of ours at the reading that we did earlier this week for our Poetry a Day group. And she came to the reading and she said that initially when she heard that we were declaring fatwas, she was really turned off by it. But she started listening to us and then she really loved listening to our podcast. And I think that's part of what we're doing in this podcast and what we do as activists is reclaiming words and remaking them ours the way they're authentically meant to be ours.
Yes. Well said.
And that's our fatwa.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how people respond to a fatwa, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I say Allahu Akbar. I say takbir.
Okay. So Good Muslim Award time.
Yes. Who do you have an award to give to?
Rhonda Girar.
Who is a fantastic writer.
Her piece is How Being a Bad Muslim Helped Me Get Out of a Bad Marriage.
It was a really well done piece.
Oh, it was so juicy.
It was juicy. That's the perfect word for that.
And I'm also really annoyed that, like, there were folks on Twitter, there were specifically men on Twitter who were, like, bad-mouthing the writing for being too sensationalist.
Yeah.
And, like, seedy on purpose. Which is like, hold on. Some of this critique is actually sounding not like it's about writing and more like it's about sexism.
Yeah.
Like if it's a little too bold for you and made you have like really big feelings, that's actually pretty good writing, I think. I think that's a good measure.
Absolutely. I always think about that when people respond to my writing. If I make people upset and have feelings, then I'm doing my good job.
Exactly. Exactly.
I am doing my job. Her piece was great. It was about how she cheated on her husband. And not that I'm advocating cheating on your husband, but I think the way she wrote it was really well done.
Why are you looking at me while you say this?
I was looking down intentionally at the carpet, so I wasn't making eye contact with you.
I'm actually going to make my husband read this piece.
You should.
Because, well, okay, you got to read the piece, folks who are listening. It's really, really well done. It's really well crafted. One of the things that I love about it is that, like, she really, like, gives it to the guy. Like, she dishes it good.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to give anything away. Just go read it.
Yeah, just go read it. Just go read it. So that's our Good Muslim Award this month. I have an awkward Ask a Muslim.
Oh, goody.
I went to the desert to write. I love the desert. I'm in LA, so Joshua Tree and Palm Springs aren't too far away. So I was there for a week. And on our last night there, we went to eat at a Middle Eastern restaurant. It was me and Jenny Yang. And we go there, and I'm really curious. How did this Middle Eastern restaurant show up in Yucca Valley, where there's no Muslims around, or Arabs or Middle Easterns around for miles? And I walk in, and we sit down, and I start talking to Jenny. I'm like, do you think they're Muslim? Where do you think these people are from? Should I ask? Should I not ask? What am I supposed to do? And I eventually, when I went to go pay the bill, I went and asked her. I was like, oh, where are you from? And she said she was from Jordan. And then I said, oh, are you Muslim? And she's like, no. Then I was like, oh, I felt really guilty for asking that question because I didn't want to project my... Then I was like, oh, I'm Muslim. And she's like, well, do you speak Arabic? I was like, I learned the letters in Muslims. school. It was super awkward. And she had a very clear accent, and I felt terrible. Because I don't want to project my Muslimness on other Middle Eastern and Arabs.
Did you microaggress her?
I was trying not to. I was trying to, like, be really gentle in how I microaggressed her, but I obviously failed. Because I wanted to know. I'm curious about people's stories, you know? So when I'm in the desert and there's, like, an Arab and Muslim or Middle Eastern or whatever, like, I want to know.
Yeah, totally.
And I felt really bad afterwards. It was a hookah bar, too.
Oh, come on.
I know. What's your awkward ask a Muslim?
Okay, so I have this thing about designer bags.
Yes, because you're, like, Persian.
Designer apparel.
Because you're Persian.
Because I'm Persian.
Yeah. Not Iranian. This is where your Persian side comes out.
Well, no, actually, it's pretty damn Iranian. Chanel is pretty fucking hot, like, in Iran. But the designer bag, that, like, it's a thing, and designer wear, Prada, is very Persian. And I've, like, I walked into, like, a Prada shop one time and almost walked out with a $3,200 bag.
I do not relate to this narrative at all.
I almost handed her, like, 3 credit cards.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, my eyes were, like, aglow, and I, like, snapped out of it when she was like, they're all declined. And I was like, thank God. That was so close. Good. What happened?
Good.
I went down the Persian rabbit hole. Okay, so for 3 years, I've been like, I'm gonna get the designer bag.
Yeah.
And it's gonna, like, I'll connect with it somehow. It'll, like, you know.
Yeah.
I'll justify it because it'll have this, like, you know, long-term utility.
Yeah, people always say that about bags, and I don't understand that.
Be quiet. Okay, so I finally see a bag that I, like, point to because it was my birthday.
Yeah.
It was my birthday in June, and my mom wanted to, like, get me a bag.
Yeah.
Because I've been, like, asking about it forever. And every year she buys me one and I return it. Okay? So, like, this year we went to Nordstrom's together. I'm looking at the bags for an hour and a half. I finally spot one that I love.
Right. Awesome.
It's like Michael Kors or Marc Jacobs. I don't know which of it. But the more expensive one. It's, like, black and sleek and super sexy. And it's, like, a little bit bigger than a laptop bag. And I'm like, yes.
Right.
And my mom got it for me.
Awesome.
And I'm, like, sporting it around. Then there's, like, this little pad roll in it.
Yeah.
That I was like, oh, like, we have evolved because, like, we wrap our iPads and
round padding.
Like, sure. Because, like,
and it's got all these pockets in it.
Tons of, and it's, like, it's a diaper bag.
Oh, you didn't know it was a diaper bag.
It was a diaper bag.
You know what I hear? First comes the diaper bag, then comes the baby. I think that's a saying. It's a Persian proverb.
Yeah. Can I put the baby in the diaper bag and just take it on the road?
I think that's how those diaper bags work, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was a comedian's diaper bag.
How did you discover this, though?
Okay, so the pad that I mentioned?
Yeah.
I saw my friend roll it down to change her baby.
Oh, and then you were like, oh, wait a second. Did you ask her about that? You're like, oh, hey, what's that pad that you're pulling out of your bag?
2 days later? Like, in that moment, a light bulb went off in my head, and I was like, huh. And then, like, 2 days later, I was like, I think I bought a diaper bag. And then she just burst out with, oh, yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Why did you buy a diaper bag? And she had known the whole time. And then I asked other friends, and they were like, yeah, I didn't know why you bought a diaper bag, but I just figured.
Everyone knew?
Everyone knew it was a diaper bag.
Oh, my gosh, you just mommed yourself. All the moms are going to look at you and go like, oh, Zara must have a secret baby somewhere because she's rolling around with a diaper bag.
This is, like, hitting me in all the uncomfortable spaces of, like, taking up too much space, having too much stuff, being a bag lady, being a hoarder, and, like, having a whole other human size worth amount of stuff.
Oh,
I need to, like, carry around.
Diaper bag.
Oh, God. I need to minimize my life.
You should Marie Kondo that shit.
What's that?
It's the one where you get rid of things that don't bring you
joy. Oh,
the
book.
Yeah.
Oh, the method.
The method. Joy. Only have joy. Well, on that note, we hope you've had a joyous time listening to our podcast. We're coming to an end. Zara, what do you have coming up?
I am featured as a KQED woman to watch. I'll be doing comedy shows in the Bay Area all fall. I've also been named by the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts as a top 100 list of people, organizations, and movements shaping the future of culture in the nation. That's pretty cool.
That's
kind of a big title there.
That's kind of exciting.
I'm shaping the future of culture, Taz.
That's awesome.
You know who else is on the list with me?
Not me.
Oh. Well, you're not in the Bay Area.
Right, right, right.
Though Trevor Noah's not in the Bay Area. He's on the list. Reza Aslan and me on
Anyways.
The list. Bjork is on the list. I'm on a list with Bjork.
Anyways.
Are you on the list?
You know what list I am on?
What?
I am on the list of people that are going to be performing in D.C. on the weekend of July 27th, 28th, 29th at the Smithsonian APA Lit Festival.
Oh, damn.
Come on out. I'll be doing workshops on Muslim Valentine's Day cards. I'll be performing, and I will have chapbooks for sale.
Okay, next time I'm going to come back with some performance, like, at the Getty or something.
Yeah. Yeah, you do that.
Keep up.
You know what we can come back with? Next time, we will be recording from Hawaii at the Shangri-La Center in Honolulu. And we're super excited. They've invited us out there for a week-long art residency. So if you are in Hawaii, all of our Hawaiian listeners, go out to Honolulu. We'll have more information on our website.
And because it's a sex episode, before we close, we got to say something sexy.
But I can't say anything sexy because I'm not married.
But if you could say something sexy, what would it be if you were to have a dirty imagining?
You know, I'm in my childhood bedroom right now. That's where we're recording. And this is not the place for me to have sexy thoughts, Zara.
There you have it.
What's your sexy thought in my childhood teenage bedroom?
Your poster of the Comidas is pretty hot.
It's hot.
I'm going to leave with that sexy thought.
Yeah, you do that. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast, hosted by Taz Ahmed and Zara Nurmash. You can follow Taz on Twitter at TazzyStar, that's TAZZYSTAR, and Zara at Zara Comedy, that's ZAHRA Comedy. The show is produced and edited by Quincy Sarasmith, and you can find us on the web at GoodMuslimBadMuslim.com. To follow the conversation, please use the hashtag GoodMuslimBadMuslim. Good Muslim, Bad Muslim is a proud member of Potluck, a collective that features stories and voices from the Asian American community.
Holy
Potluck.
Potluck.
So one day you're going to get hella kinky, Taz.
Apparently.